The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Well, hello there. This is Fred Brack reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now we return one more time to the October 2022 issue of Our State. The theme this month has been Mountain Moods, and boy, I don't think we've even done half the magazine. It's a really big one. It's almost 300 pages. And we're going to start as we usually do, because this is the last reading of the month with the 1980s, the Decade of Local Heroes series. Getting pretty close to starting a new decade in January, but we'll have, we've got November and December to find out how they're finishing out the 1980s. This month, Philip Gerard writes about the city that almost wasn't. Can you guess what that might be? By the early 1980s, downtown Asheville is struggling. But when a plan to jumpstart the area threatens to alter its character, locals spring into action, taking steps toward a brighter future. Many cities are known for signature landmarks. Others build a piece of their legacy on what wasn't constructed, what was instead preserved and transformed. Such is the story of Asheville and the downtown mall that never was. Asheville began in 1797 as an outpost at the edge of the wilderness. From this crossroads of rivers and Native American trails, pioneers traveled west into the Blue Ridge. A century later, served by a railroad, the settlement has matured into a city of some 10,000, not counting the summer residents who crowded in to escape the malarial heat to the east. By the early 20th century, Asheville was well known for resorts such as the Grove Park Inn, a stunning granite monolith on Sunset Mountain. The building boom continued through the 1920s, led by prominent architects like Douglas Ellington, a North Carolina native who made his mark on the city with such magisterial projects as First Baptist Church and Asheville City Hall, combining Beaux Arts and Art Deco styles, and Asheville High School with its exterior walls of pink granite. Meanwhile, scores of other commercial buildings were going up, along with houses and apartments, stretching the ability of the city's infrastructure to serve them all. Asheville began borrowing so heavily that by the time the Great Depression set in, the city's debt exceeded the combined total of that of Greensboro, Winston-Salem, Durham, and Raleigh. Thus, from the 1930s on, cash-strapped Asheville could make very little public investment in its downtown. It took nearly half a century to pay off that crippling debt, and by 1976, the downtown had suffered another economic blow. The Asheville Mall on Tunnel Road. One of about 800 such suburban malls in the country, it was part of a commercial real estate movement that drew shoppers away from downtown legacy stores. The core of old department stores shuttered, the municipal water system was failing, crime was on the rise, and fires became a continuing hazard. The city proposed to bulldoze the existing structures and replace them with an indoor mall developed by Philadelphia real estate firm Strauss, Greenberg and Company. The 1974 Asheville Downtown Commercial Complex redevelopment plan justified the move. years of neglect, deterioration, and functional obsolescence of the buildings in the area have caused the area to become blighted. This plan is an effort to accomplish a turnaround in the status of the area. In 1980, building inspectors began assessing 85 structures in the Lexington Park area, which some suspect is meant to provide a pretext for demolition. Unsurprisingly, not one of them meets the current building code. So city leaders determined to raise 11 blocks of downtown Asheville, nearly 23 acres, which will displace 125 commercial businesses, two nonprofits, and a workforce of nearly 500 people. The new mall will include almost 600,000 square feet of retail space in department stores, shops, and restaurants, plus a 300-room hotel. But once again, the issue is money. $40 million in two municipal bonds to start with, $22 million for parking and infrastructure, and $18 million for redevelopment. And taxpayers will have to approve the general obligation bonds. For if the mall fails, the city must still pay back the full amount at 10.5% annual interest. The scope of the project is hard to envision. To educate her fellow citizens, artist Peggy L. Gardner, a senior at UNC Asheville, comes up with a plan inspired by Christo's The Running Fence, an installation of white nylon sheeting along 24.5 miles of Freeway 101 north of San Francisco. On April 19, 1980, she supervises a crew of 135 volunteers to wrap the huge area of the proposed mall development in cloth sheets tied together during a marathon all-night session. 15 runners move the sheets along the perimeter of the site. This is not a protest, she tells the Asheville Citizen, but an educational event to visually focus the public's attention on the area to inform them of which buildings are under question. Many residents are appalled by the mall plan, including Catherine Long, a business owner in the affected area. She and her brother-in-law, Wayne Caldwell, and others found an organization called Save Downtown Asheville Incorporated. Long owns Ambiance Interiors, housed next door to Sluder Furniture Company, which her family has operated since 1964. She herself is no stranger to the sudden destruction of cherished property. Her family's home burned to the ground on Christmas Day, 1953. I remember being held by a fireman that day, and they salvaged a set of building blocks, she says. Those were the first toys I remember. As a little girl, she began designing homes on the back of church bulletins and eventually earned a BFA in interior design and an MA in art history. By instinct and training, she's passionate about the preservation and revitalization of beautiful architecture. In 1980, she tells UNCTV of the solid and spacious structure that houses Ambiance. Brick built, easy to heat and cool, with room to expand on the upper floors. She debunks the notion that downtown Asheville businesses can't thrive in their current location. Ironically enough, Strauss, Greenberg & Company had a company in Washington, D.C., do a study about where they should locate their mall. And the study showed that at the very best location would be for retail was downtown Asheville. What can I say? But, well, I've known that for quite a while. That's why my property is valuable, and that's why I want to stay here. She cites the area's designation on the National Register of Historic Places. Thomas Wolfe sold papers in this building as a boy. It's valuable in that way, she says. But most important is the flawed reasoning behind the mall plan. We think that the Strauss-Greenberg plan is in direct opposition to the original revitalization plan, which is still the official plan of the city to revitalize downtown through restoration, not through destruction. She takes the city planners to task. There's room for a lot of growth. It's just that certain people don't seem to know how to go about it, and therefore they will take whatever plan just falls into their lap and looks easy. Our way may be more difficult. It won't take any longer, however, and it will be better in the end. Meanwhile, John Lantzios and his sister Dawn have been hard at work renovating buildings for the new business tenants in advance of their proposed demolition. Roger McGuire, an advertising executive who retires to Asheville in 1980, campaigns for a performing and visual arts center, Pack Place. He and his wife, Pat, donate generously to the project. The conflict comes to a head on October 23, 1981, when Save Downtown Asheville and city representatives address the issue in a televised debate at First Baptist Church, itself an architectural landmark. Voters subsequently reject the bonds and the mall by a margin of 2-1. Long's vision proves prescient. Rather than one grand, destructive corporate stroke, Asheville chooses a different way. With the mall plan scrapped, government leaders step up. They build parking garages when many remain skeptical that the downtown will attract enough traffic. They approve liquor by the drink and sidewalk dining, luring visitors downtown. Soon, a critical mass of artists and other creative professionals choose to live and work in Asheville. Philanthropist Julian Price, who moves to Asheville in 1989, invests millions in for-profit projects that also count as investments in the community, as well as a range of nonprofit and loan initiatives to support affordable housing, childcare, schools, and minority-owned and green businesses. He partners with Pat Whalen to form Public Interest Projects, a for-profit enterprise with a mission to create vibrant, livable city through targeted investment. Julian was behind the scenes by choice, but he was involved in everything, says Kim McGuire, the first program director of the Price-established Dogwood Fund, which awards grants to startups that add value to the community. His legacy will live well beyond his years because of who he was and what he did with the resources he had. Long is right. It is hard work to fulfill a new vision of the downtown, and it happens individual by individual, business by business, one flower opening at a time, until Asheville becomes the city that Long, Caldwell, Price, and so many other forward thinkers imagined. Coming next month, architecture Harvey Gantt is elected the first black mayor of Charlotte. And now, since we have talked so much about Asheville, we're going to go to the section of the magazine which discusses Asheville and environs. We won't get to all of them, but Black Mountain, Burnsville, Hot Springs, Marshall, Mars Hills, and Weaverville are the environs. In this area of the Blue Ridge, bohemian sensibilities and nonconformist attitudes combine to create a signature aesthetic. Very pretty picture here. There's a caption which says, around Asheville and everywhere in the region, people have influenced this part of the state in their own ways, but a sunset near Mount Mitchell endures. We have a slightly sloping downward to the left. I wouldn't call it, it's not a field, it's a small forest area. There are some tall pines that are poking through the smaller bush-type trees and actual bushes that are there. But they're quite tall, whatever is down below, because these pine trees are very tall. In the foreground are some rocks, and then the mountain just drops off, and what we see is a cloud down below the level where we're at. We're looking at the top of the cloud, and beyond that cloud, in the wispy part of that cloud, we see the other side of this gap, and there are clouds gathered along the top of the gap there. It's like snow, but there it's so fluffy you can tell that they are clouds, and then in the distance, a beautiful sunset. Asheville's Voice is the first article. To an untrained ear, the sounds emanating from downtown street corners form a cacophony of drums and strings and synthesizers. To musicians and poets and music lovers, it's a distinctive symphony like no other. Written by Keith Flynn. Let us begin in the center. Pack Square Park. In the heart of downtown Asheville, and follow the sound of drums in the distance. Within two blocks, our feet will switch from a casual walk to an anchor for our hips to sway, moved by a tribe of like-minded lovers of rhythm. A percussion circle in Pritchard Park is contributing to a groove that cannot be stopped. Hands clasping tambourines, bongos, washboards scraped with metal picks, African drums clenched between players' knees, cowbells, cymbals, woodblocks slapped together or banged with sticks. One child has a hubcap that she pucks with a rock. There are a trio of belly dancers clicking their castanets as the hips rock and sway, and every person present, regardless of gender, creed, or color, claps along. One elderly couple, with their long gray braids swishing through the air, attempt a rumba. Children bounce and jump and squeal. All the glorious hands slap and thrust in tandem. Surrounding this beautiful exuberance are buskers ensconced in their own bubbles of music, each staking out a street corner and dropping a hat to gather change. Buskers have long been a component that defines the city. And in 2014, the Asheville Buskers Collective was established by Abby, the Spoon Lady Roach, whose flashing silver utensils create hypersonic polyrhythms as she sinks like a Buddha into the blues rockability of her compatriots. Classically trained dancers and athletic hip-hop enthusiasts trade pirouettes and pelvic thrusts as they respond to the songs emanating from their boomboxes. Asheville is a town made for drifting, like a bullseye surrounded by interlocking highways that lures artists, musicians, and truth-seekers to come and settle for a spell. Or forever. Take Lyle Rickards, who's perched in a storefront, fingering his dulcimer and toting a can of bear mace, should anyone get any nefarious ideas about his collection plate. Nearby, Bobby Sachs presses his lips against his horn after an Asheville tourist baseball game. And then there's Dade Murphy, a living silver statue inside his painted business suit, and mime-influenced gesticulations make him appear in constant thrall to the wind and the passing cars. Yet a child's gentle pat on his belly can send him into a joyous series of disciplined shivers. North, just away from downtown, inside the Moog Museum, electronic notes and chords beep, squawk, swell, and fade like robots in conversation. Just as children acquire language to tell the stories that are already within them, Robert Moog used his fascination with the theremin to create the world's first commercial keyboard synthesizer, which changed the face of music forever. Eventually, like so many others, he found his way to Asheville, where he taught at the University of North Carolina at Asheville, and continued to work on designs for instruments whose otherworldly soundscapes challenge and delight generations of innovative composers and listeners. Continue with me on a northwest cruise along the French Broad River, listening to the wind in the pines and the rustle of rhododendrons next to the gurgling water. Birds and crickets and frogs take turns as their part of the symphony. Let's take a rest at the Marshall Depot, where the Southern Railway stopped for passengers until the 1970s. A handful of local bands are scheduled every Friday night, and there's no admission fee. Of the former train station opens its doors to professionals and front porch amateurs alike, who ply their country and bluegrass chops. Famed songwriter Mickey Newbury once told me that the blues come from the sound of a train clacking down the track. You're either blue because you can hear it coming and you cannot ride, or blue because it's leaving and passed you by. Fiddle players from every nook, cranny, and holler in Madison County find their way to the Marshall Depot, sawing on their instruments and measuring their worth. But the gold standard for bluegrass fiddle players stands and delivers at the other end of town. At Zuma Coffee and Provisions, Thursday night jam in the hallowed personage of Bobby Hicks. dubbed by bluegrass legend Bill Monroe as the truest fiddler I've ever heard. 89-year-old Hicks has played on more than 50 albums and won 3 Grammys, and he invites anyone with sufficient gumption to share the stage and play with him. Chicken-picking banjo players and harmonica aficionados match wits and licks with the master. Bluegrass lovers and mournful ballad singers converge in the sleepy little town and wake it up most weekends, sharing the age-old tragedies that make it best for the best ballads. The dirt-poor heartbreak of unrequited love and the high plaintive lonesome hiccups that stab into the listener's broken places and settle there. I have stood on Mount Mitchell, the highest mountaintop in the eastern United States, near the origin of the South Tow River, water so cold it takes your breath away when you leap into its hidden swimming holes. I stood on the crest of that mountain, 6,600 feet high, and could hear a marching band playing during halftime of the local high school football game many miles away. I imagined the frills and hats, the horns lifted in harmony, and the wash-tub thump of the bass drum keeping time. A little hoot owl was roused by the same atmospheric rumble and followed me down the trail, calling, flitting from tree to tree in the darkness. I hurled my whole self into that stillness, surrendering to the multiverse of sonic architecture that is never completed, but erected one melody at a time, as the excited nocturnal bird strings out its contribution beneath a billion stars, making a necklace of shimmering notes that pull me home. And I don't know if we have enough time here to read this, but we might as well get started, right? The bar that launched 1,000 restaurants. When the Admiral opened 15 years ago, the dive bar with world-class food helped usher in a new era for Asheville. Together, both restaurant and city became nationally recognized destinations. Written by C.A. Carlson. Before there was Asheville, vacation destination and regular resident of top 10 lists for dining and drinking, there was Asheville, a mountain town surrounded by beauty, but struggling to find its footing after a century of economic boom and bust. When I first visited the city nearly 15 years ago, my local friends told me that we were going to the hot new restaurant on the west side. But when we pulled up outside an unassuming cinder block building across the street from a rundown gas station, I was doubtful. The interior muttered dive bar. Low ceilings, low lights, pleather booths, and a formica bar crowded with young customers drinking PBRs. And then I had a plate of perfect short ribs and a cocktail as well-crafted as any I'd found at upscale urban bars. We lingered until we saw the staff moving tables. As we got up to leave, we found out that they were clearing a dance floor. The joint was soon shaking to the sound of soul music, and as I stomped and shimmied the night away, I thought, what is this place? This place was the Admiral. And almost a decade and a half later, several lifetimes in the restaurant industry business, where the average independent business closes in 5 years or less, it's still going strong in the neighborhood I now call home. When the Admiral opened on December 12, 2007, in the depths of the Great Recession, Asheville had not yet secured its reputation as one of the country's food capitals. The Admiral, with its comfortable old-school atmosphere and its ambitious new southern menu, helped define the kind of creative cuisine and offbeat experience that the city would become known for. Asheville has always been a magical place, but it was really hungry for a lot back then, says co-owner Drew Wallace. People were searching for something different, and we were young and dumb enough to open a restaurant in that part of town in the middle of a recession. Wallace, who got his start in the industry as a line cook and a bartender, and Elliot Moss, the Admiral's first chef, had worked together at The Wig in Columbia, South Carolina, which proudly proclaims itself to be North America's greatest dive bar. Their former boss, Jonathan Robinson, joined them as a co-owner in the Asheville venture. At that time, you could see the city was changing, Robinson says. In those early days, West Asheville really helped to start and sustain us. DJs Whitney Schroyer and Greg Cartwright tapped into their personal vinyl collections to get the dance floor going every Saturday night. In the kitchen, too, Moss was pushing beyond Southern favorites, including killer catfish sandwiches and continental classics like beef tartare, to encompass more global influences. Soon, not the only the neighborhood, but the growing tide of tourists and the media began to take notice. Moss received a James Beard nomination for his work at the restaurant in early 2013. The Boston Globe called the Admiral a destination restaurant in a hipster mecca. Perhaps like Asheville itself, the attention made us grow up quickly, maybe faster than we had planned, Wallace said. We never thought that we'd receive the accolades we did, and we're still catching up with that. I would never put a tablecloth in this restaurant, but we have tried to polish without over-polishing. The ceilings are still low, but they're covered in elegant pressed tin now. There's a patio and a fireplace and fresh paint. The dance parties eventually ended, and the more seating was added to accommodate the growing crowds. In 2013, Moss left the Admiral to start his Whole Hog Barbecue restaurant, Buxton Hall, which was named one of Bon Appetit's best new restaurants the year after it opened in 2015. Kitchens all over town are helmed by Admiral alumni. So many people have used this as a launching pad, which really feels great. Wallace says, it says something special that these people wanted to work here before they did their own thing. And some staff members choose to stay. Current head chef Chuck Bowden-Dissel remembers his first day in the Admiral's kitchen 7 years ago as a graduate of Le Cordon Bleu of Pittsburgh. I showed up in my white chef's coat and checkered pants because I thought the food was at that level and everyone else was wearing shorts and t-shirts, he recalls. The bartender called me top chef for 3 months, but I got a taste of this place and never wanted to leave. Bowden-Dissel has embraced the challenge of caretaking a legend while bringing his own spin to the Admiral's menu. A native of Western New York State, he put pierogi, a filled dumpling brought to that region by Polish infants, on the pasta menu, but he's also proud of the local mushrooms in a green tea dashi with preserved kumquats and toasted buckwheat from a nearby Miller farm and sparrow. Oh, we're going to have to cut it off right now, but they're on Haywood Road in Asheville, the AdmiralAsheville.com. Hey, that's all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine. Hope you enjoyed it enough. You'll come back to listen next time when we open the cover on the November issue. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments, questions, call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening.